Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Author Owen McNamee, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brendan.
So Owen, your latest novel is called The Bureau, and it is an absolutely fantastic evoking of life around the border back in the day and the textures of it and everything. And this extraordinary cast of characters leading kind of grim, kind of Wild West lives almost. And what I didn't realise then reading it is that it's actually based on your own family story. So I suppose your books have always had elements of real stories and history in them. How did you decide to write about your own family? I think it happened in a Netflix writing room, weirdly, didn't it?
It did. I was working in Vikings Valhalla and in a break. But when we kind of started to start with where the Bureau came from, the idea of my father was a very well-got solicitor in the North during the Troubles, during the early Troubles, very highly respected, but got himself into trouble over money, went bankrupt, got struck off, charged with fraud, ended up in mental institutions, you know, I think half because he had an issue and half because he was trying to avoid sort of the people who were after him, you know, these kind of fraud charges. But when he got clear of it, in a brilliant maverick idea, which is very typical of a man, he opened a Bureau de Change on the border, the very first Bureau de Change on the border in Newry, which was a brilliant idea. I mean, it made money, but it started to store problems again and crashed in a very devastating way for the family and for anybody around him in his orbit. And I realised, now this is going back over 30 years ago, and I mean, I had all this material. I wrote, you know, many books in between, and I never could find a way of approach it. And I actually realised it was trauma, I think, that stood between me and it, and the kind of trauma to the family. I didn't want to go near it. And I was doing the Netflix writer's room, and I was talking to one of the producers when we were having coffee. I told her some of the stories about this time, and she said, that's The Sopranos. And I thought that for some reason that knocked it loose into something I could tell, something I could make a book around.
Okay, now, you skipped over that extraordinary epic story of your father there. Let's go back and break that down a bit. So he was initially like this well-respected solicitor and everything. Did he represented the Hooded Men at one point?
He represented the Hooded Men, yeah. But some of my, I mean, I was always a reader, but some of the early reading was he had their testimonies at home, sitting on a dining room table, and I read through these things, and because, you know, I was only 10 or 11. And they were terrifying. And they were terrifying because you could smell the fear coming off the page. And the knowledge of, I mean, one of the things that doesn't come out is that those guys thought they were going to be killed at the end of this because they thought they can't do this to us and let us live.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose, it kind of built itself into my worldview in a way.
Yeah. So your father was this kind of, like before the Troubles came along, I guess, your father was this respectable kind of, your parents would have been kind of progressive
Northern
people living in the mainstream kind of world.
They were progressive. I mean, and, you know, my mother was an art teacher. They thought things were going to change, and they didn't see this train wreck that was coming down the track at them in 1969, both for society and for them, in fact, in the end.
And are you old enough to remember then when the British Army arrived, the checkpoint started on the border?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I remember that. I remember, I mean, for an instance, and somebody said, why the telephones keep coming up in your work? And I tracked it back to, I was the lightest sleeper in the house. So when a phone call came in the middle of the night where somebody had been raided, somebody had been lifted, I would go down and answer it. Again, a youngster in my pyjamas.
Yeah.
And I remember one particular incident where somebody's son had been thrown down the stairs and by the army and taken off in a jeep, and this woman was crying down the phone. I can still remember the feel of the cold parquet floor on my feet and the moon flooding the room.
And so what it was the beginning of the border as it became then, that created this world that the book is set in, which is kind of, you call it a world of the withheld. You were required to intuit things, meaning shifted, full of plants, informers, dark betrayal. So the world up around there changed to this kind of shifty, kind of lawless kind of situation, was it?
You know, a border to me is, you know, when you see particularly around Brexit and that, they show the border, they show kind of fields and cows.
Yeah.
It's like that's not what a border is. I mean, a border is a sinister thing. It's what a colonial power leaves behind the landscape and pulls out. And it makes everything around it provisional and shifty, if you like. I mean, if you look at all the harms going on in the world at the minute, if you look at Palestine, Yeah. That goes right through to the Sikhs Pico line, things like that. India, Pakistan, Trump's wall, the dreadful wall that Europe has erected between itself and Africa, which isn't a wall, in fact, but it's actually paying warlords to stop people coming across. You know, so that is bordered. And I mean,
so the ground is shifting under everyone's feet all the time.
I think something about it that I the analogy I made from it, and people will I think identify with this, is that if you're the family of an alcoholic or somebody who's abusive, and my father was an alcoholic, he wasn't abusive, but he was an alcoholic. When the key comes in the door at night, the whole house goes into hyper alertness. The dread that seeps through the entire place. And if you take that, that's a kind of private thing. But the border was like that in a public way. It was full of dread. People were hyper alert all the time.
Okay. So your father then, he's this kind of, we call it respectable kind of solicitor. He got struck off then. Was that what kind of changed everything for him? Why was he struck off?
He was struck off essentially for dipping into client funds and the Law Society started to investigate it. And in actual fact, when in the heel of the hunt, his practice was actually solvent, he just hadn't sent the bills out. He was a man who's, I think, his best characteristics were also his worst characteristics. You know, he had no respect for authority, which you needed in those times, which was his best characteristic. He had no respect for authority, which is also his worst characteristic, you know. So he was always the most, I'd say, most intelligent man in the room, but he was never the shrewdest man in the room.
Okay, you know? Yeah. A big theme in a lot of your books, I think, is exploring why do good people turn bad. Did something corrupt your father then, do you think?
I would say he was kind of corrupted by his own qualities. I mean, he was an alcoholic, gambler, perhaps that kind of thing of being intelligent but not being shrewd. But I think the wider society, he believed in the law. And my mother sort of said when he was first practicing, he was very upright, very upright. But of course, I mean, the law, like everyone else in the North, had been distorted and corrupted by sectarianism and everything else that went along with that. And I think, I wouldn't say that broke him, but something in him broke.
Yeah.
And I mean, I use the word corrupted to myself, but the poet Anne Carson has a phrase, which I kind of use about him. He had no home and goodness anymore.
Okay. And what about his actual home and goodness? Like your mother, when this all started happening, him, how did she cope with it?
My mother, when he lost the first house in County Down, or our first house, he said, if you separate, you can probably keep the house. And she said, no. So we skipped across the border, but we were only really one step ahead of the forces that were coming after him. You know, the border was no defence to us in that. He was trying to use it to shield him from all this. But my mother, I mean, when he went bankrupt the second time, which was catastrophic, because he couldn't have a bank account, he put everything into my mother's name. And she was old school, you know. She liked her garden. She liked her, you know, play bridge game. She liked art. So she had no real notion of what he was doing. But he put everything into her name. And then bankrupted her for hundreds of thousands. And I remember standing outside the forecourts with her when all this broke. And it was the one time I saw her falter. She looked up and down the street. She was going in for bankruptcy hearing, very intimidating, and to see was he coming. Because law was his game, you know, and you know, he should have been there, but he didn't come.
What effect did all of it have on you?
Part of him said, we kind of blocked it. Put it, well, I mean, when the second time broke, I was in Spain with my girlfriend on top of a mountain writing poetry, incommunicado, there was no electricity in this place. But the rumour went around that I was in Spain stashing money. So some of these guys came down to the Bureau in Uri and lifted my brother, put a bag over his head, took him up in South Armagh, into a shed, interrogated him there, and eventually let him go, which is not the catastrophic outcome you might expect from something like that happened to you. So, I mean, all those things. I asked him, we were talking about this and about being traumatised. He said, no, I never thought at any point they were going to kill me. He said, but the worst thing was not being able to go into your hometown, Uri, for years and then, because, you know, these guys, you always wondered in relation to my father, whether they decide you took something of ours, we'll take something of yours.
So that hung over your brother always.
Yeah.
So maybe we should explain how it unravelled for your father then. So who were the guys? So hang on. We start with, it all came out of the Bureau de Change.
Yeah.
So he set that up. He's a drinker and a gambler and kind of hanging around with shady characters at this stage. But he set that up. It's successful business initially.
Very successful initially, yeah. There was nowhere else to change money. You know, the bank shut. Your car didn't work both sides of the border. You know, so it was very successful, yeah.
Yeah. And then what happened?
I think he was gambling and I think he needed to make more and more money. And he set up, as far as I, looking back, I could figure out, it was a kind of Ponzi scheme. So he's robbing Peter to pay Paul. And as long as he could keep that all balanced, keep all those balls in the air,
yeah,
it was okay. And then just once one ball fell, that was it.
There was some big scam with traveller's checks. It's the real sign of the times, traveller's checks.
Yeah, I know. I put this together long after he died. I
think, yeah.
What about that? And what about that? And what about that? And kind of realised, he cashed stolen American Express checks and then had to sue American Express because they smelled a rat.
Yeah.
Rightly smelled a rat.
So fair play to him. He went and sued them.
He sued them for, Well, I mean, no respect for authority.
Yeah. Okay. So he brazened it out.
Mm.
So, and then am I getting the impression that the people he was dealing with were the wrong kind of people? Were they, like, were these people actually, like, political people or was it just kind of gangsterism or was it a mix of both?
It was probably a mix of both. Probably a mix of both, yeah. I mean, it was diesel oil and all that kind of thing.
Okay. And then it's you say about your brother and the kidnapping. You were very embroiled in it. Like, there's a scene in the book, which I believe is true. So your father's in a psychiatric institution and he stashed some
files in the roof space. This is in John of God's. I myself and my mother went to see him. It was a school night, so I was still in school uniform, like 16 or whatever. And some reason, somehow he got these files that he didn't want anyone to see up into the roof space of John God's. And he sent me off through a back door and I climbed up. And I remember that there was a real terror around like what he'd done. Or what, anyway, but you're standing there in John God's and in the roof space there were no planks. There were just the joists. He had to step across the joists. And the end of this corridor, I could see this room with the files sitting on a chair and the wind was roaring around the place and you know, slates were clattering and you'd hear lost voices coming up from the ward underneath.
Yeah.
It was a strange, to the point where I thought, did that actually happen? And then I met a neighbour who had worked in John of God's and I described the geography to him and he said, no, you're dead right.
And this was your normality though, as a kid?
Some of it, certainly, yeah, around that time, certainly, yeah.
And would he go to John of God's? Was that to hide out as well, kind of thing?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that at some stage he had a breakdown of some sort, but it's a kind of a border thing, you know, something happens to you or you're in trouble with the law.
Yeah.
Get yourself committed.
Okay. Did he have a mentality of he was always kind of on the run in a way, like?
No, not really. As I described the people in the book, you know, they're the kind of people that the game only starts when you get caught.
Yeah.
You know, for the rest of us, you know, okay, you put your hands up and go, okay, right, take me away. Not for these guys, you know.
Okay. In the book as well, this must have been a hard thing to do in a way. You give your father a mistress, Jean. You've a great line about your father and the men he hung around with. These men needed women to fill their house of silence.
Yeah, well, I mean, when he first went bankrupt, we found he had a mistress we didn't know about, a house we didn't know about, and a mistress he didn't know about. But this is, this was another woman, this was kind of later on, yeah, whom I knew he had, I saw in the distance, but I didn't know her.
And your mother would have been aware, would she?
I'm not sure she was aware about that. She knew about the first one. I'm not sure she knew about that. But,
okay.
You know, my mother loved him, you know. To the end, yeah.
And wouldn't have a word said against him.
Oh, I wouldn't say that, no.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but still, she stuck with him through it all, didn't she?
When he died of cancer, when he got cancer, she took him in again. So.
And listen, so you had a lot more to put up with as well. There were, I think, robbery attempts on the family as well. Was there a kind of a tiger kidnapping at one stage where you were held
in the house? Yeah, my brother and mother were held in the house waiting for for my father to come home with the keys to the business so we could get at the safe or whatever. And my other brother, who's as brave as a lion, he pulled up, he raised one of the stair rods of this, so he pulled one of the stair rods out, whacked one of these guys and took to his heels, you know. That's the kind of dread that hung over you every day. I mean, it was a place with a magnet for everybody, with a with a shotgun and a bit of ambition are extortionists or fraudsters. I mean, you had to be very alert. And we worked in there, A, because it's a family business, and we had been in a lot of trouble, a lot of financial trouble, only just held on to our second house. And B, because you could be trusted, you know, to work, to carry cash around the place.
Oh, so you only trusted family, yeah?
Well, he trusted other people, which didn't work out very well. We did have people who worked there, extraordinary, great-hearted people. But he had I don't know what it was, he had a penchant for bringing people around, you know, kind of bogey, as I say, in Newry, bogey people around the place who perhaps weren't as...
Yeah, like one of those guys was, and he's kind of, in a way, it's the central core of the story. So a guy called Paddy Farrell, real guy, now dead. He was basically a kind of a high profile drug dealer by the end of his life. And a lot of the book is about imagining his relationship with his mistress, Lorraine Farrell. And it's claimed or believed that she killed both of them. In the end, again, you put that together from scraps.
I put it together from the public record, really. I decided to tell that story. I wasn't going to delve into it any further. I was just going to tell it the way it's told in the inquest and in the newspapers at the time. And the drug dealer thing, now, that came much later. I don't know about that. I don't know if that was what he was at. I mean, I knew him. I don't really think it was a cross-border thing in those days anyway.
Yeah, okay.
But other stuff that might be going. I mean, one of the precursors of the book was I came across a letter that he had written to my father from Cork Prison.
Right. Paddy Farrell is in Cork Prison.
Yeah. I couldn't find what charges, but it starts off, dear Brendan, it's Sunday here, so we have time on our hands, and goes on to, it's all kind of side of the mouth stuff and hints and people are named, but there's no second names. You know.
Yeah.
Both of them, it's coded, both of them know what he's talking about, but... Yeah, so, yeah. But, I mean, I knew Paddy, got on well with him, you know. But, I mean, there was one incident which I've written about where I was in the Bureau one Sunday evening. I was a law student in Trinity at this stage, and Paddy was there, and I was going to get the train back to Dublin, and his dad said, well, you know, Paddy will take you. And so we went across the border. He used three different forms of ID and three different names. I was stopped three times. You know, across the route down the back road. They ended up coming in Dublin down the back way, and we were driving past the forecourts, and we were laughing at the idea of, a few years' time, I'd be the guy with the wig and prosecuting, and Paddy would be the defendant. And of course, Paddy never made it that far, and I never became a lawyer.
There's a person texted here. Owen tells these stories as if the most normal experiences of life, astounding. But then you casually drop in that in the middle of all this kind of dysfunction and lawlessness and everything, you're off studying law in Trinity. So you didn't get sucked in somehow, which I presume it would have been very easy to kind of get sucked into the mire of the whole family business, like.
Not really. I mean, I wouldn't have any interest. You went in there and worked and you kept your head down, you know, kind of.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really much later that I started putting things together. Because, you know, I mean, when you think about it, you look back, he's your father and you still want to believe in him, you know, so.
Yeah.
And then you look at some of the things he did and you go...
But that's only afterwards. So at the time, he was still your dad, your hero.
Well, maybe not hero at that stage, but you know, I thought, I'm a law student, right? You put me in a car with this guy who's wanted both sides of the border. If I could stop in that car, would that be the end of my law career? Or did he even think about that?
Yeah. So you didn't become a lawyer eventually.
No.
Were you always, you said you were always a reader. Were you always kind of determined, I'm going to get out of this and there's a life there as a writer for me? Which must be unimaginable given the reality that of your life that you're, as you've laid it out, like.
Well, no, I mean, it made me want, in writing, to get closer to things, to get right up close to things, I think, which is part of the kind of style where, you know, you think there's a truth beyond what the public truth is there, and to try and get close to that. So, and, you know, writing about, you know, the Shankill Butchers and Resurrection Man, or, you know, the strange death of Robert Nyrack and things like that. But in those books, they're public events and somebody else's blood is on the floor. In this one, this is private and it's been other people's blood, but my family's blood is on the floor in it as well. I got an email from my first agent, long retired, and he said, this is the book you were born to write.
Yeah.
Human, you know, so probably, yeah.
How does it feel having written the book now and having put all that out there? Have you a slight sense of, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah, you do, of course, but I mean, a quality I think I have as a writer, maybe as a person, I'm not sure if it's necessarily an attractive one.
Yeah.
Is that there always has to be some kind of edge to it? You know, and when I'm writing it, there has to be some kind of, something has to be at stake.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they say anyway that all good writers eventually betray their family, don't they? How, there must be a lot of people, obviously, members of your family, members of that broader kind of circle that you're writing about, who are still alive, I presume. Have any of them read it, or have you had any contact from people who knew that time?
Yes, my brother read it in one sitting. The one who was kidnapped, and,
yeah.
And he said, you know, you've nailed it, you know. So yeah, I haven't had an issue. The odd thing that keeps happening is this morning, as an example, I get a message through on social media from somebody saying, you know, your father was really good to me. I really respected him. You know, that has happened quite a lot.
Yeah,
I haven't got anything saying the opposite.
Yeah,
and you know, I was kind of thinking, well. You didn't have to live with him.
Okay, yeah. So he was a good man.
He did a lot of good. I mean, I think probably the good outweighed the bad. But in all these situations, I mean, he ruined himself and he ruined his family. I think. Like we're all grown up, you know, kind of in the past now.
Yeah.
But we did go out for a meal to celebrate or to commemorate his 30th anniversary. Four brothers. Nobody thought it was a good idea. You know, there was a book opened apparently between the wives and friends as to who would fall out first.
Okay.
And we're all good pals, you know, we've never been out before. And the night didn't end very well, just kind of draw a line under it. It's all okay now. But a friend of mine had a phrase, she was estranged from her family. I said, what happened? And she said, nothing happened. I said, when we were together, we brought the hurt out in each other. And I think that's what happened that night.
Are you all traumatised?
Look, every family is traumatising. You know, we're over it. You know,
are you?
I think so. Yeah.
As long as you don't talk about it too much.
Well, it's too late for that now.
Yeah. Come here. There's another interesting little sidebar and all this, and it's fascinating. So people will remember the INLA man, Dominic Mad Dog McGlinchey. So he kind of makes a few cameos in the book. And again, I think largely based in truth. There's one extraordinary scene which is so telling about when he is shot and he's dying.
Yeah. And his son kneels in his blood and empties his pockets because that's what he was told to do. If something happened to his father, to take that there might be incriminating material there. And it's the most extraordinary scene in Drogheda.
Yeah.
And I think if Jesus, Mary, help me, is what he said.
This,
you know, stone killer who'd killed over 30 people.
Yeah, you kind of half wonder what hope has somebody whose father has trained them that well that they know what to do in that situation, and that's what they do, like a good soldier.
I think one of them passed away, and I think they were interesting young men. I think they were.
Was it your brother who remarked to you how many people had died in your father's circle, like died?
Yeah.
Not good ends. Like, I think the phrase you use in the book, if you fly with the crows, you get shot. That was the kind of milieu it was, yeah?
It was a milieu, but I mean, you know, one of the people who was shot was a friend of the High Court judge, and another was a magistrate. You know, he had friends with, friendly with a lot of Catholic policemen who got shot. But then, the whole scenario turned darker with the Bureau. And that question was asked me. I said, well, you know, it was just the Times. And then I thought, well, if it wasn't just the Times, then what was it? What slipstream did he bring with him in this kind of fast trajectory through life that made,
like,
that
did happen? Do you think the deaths in his circle were a higher average than the Times kind of thing?
I think so.
So is life cheaper in these circumstances, yeah? Is death, is somebody dying violently, untimely, is it more of a thing that people take for granted in a situation like that?
Look, Bryn, I look back on those times and the mystery just deepens for me. You know, and you know, there are glib answers you could almost give to that question. But yeah, what made that place like it was? And I mean, my take on it now is, it was always treated like it was a past bubbling up from under us. It was, which almost threw the blame back on the actors.
Explain that.
The idea that this was, you know, in the north, it was a old history between the Irish and the British, and it was a, you know, the sectarian thing, and going back to the 17th century, you know, sort of if you like. And it was almost innate in our nature to be tribal. I hate that word, yeah. Tribal. You know, like my mother was not a tribal person. You know, and it's a way of trusting blame back on the people who are caught up in that maelstrom. In actual fact, if you look at the state of the world today, I think it's actually what it was the future raining down on us. If you look at the whole kind of mass surveillance, if you look at helicopters, you know, the presence of helicopters, quadcopters now in war zones, if you look at where people are treated as less than human, and you look at the MPs, they call them Catholics vermin. The whole thing, you can look at it, and I always felt that this is not the past, this is the future.
Wow. And how do you feel about that now, when you look back on how you were then and how you were brought up and how you thought and how you saw the world and everything?
I wrote a book called The Ultralist, which was about the covert war, if you like.
Yeah.
More or less everything that I wrote at the time. Robert Nyrack, the Special Forces officer who disappeared and who's never been found. My father was brought up to counsel the guy who shot him the night after that happened. And he advised him to turn himself in. But when I started to write that book, I described the experience as not writing but falling through it. Because everything you thought was real, everything you thought had happened, turned out to have other aspects to it not to be true, that there were layers and layers and layers. So if that answers your question.
And I suppose the question I'm trying to get at as well, maybe not very well, just before we finish up, is do you see it as that everybody really was a victim of just forces bigger than them, and that people who did dreadful things, they were in a way victims too, and they had to live with that? And
I don't think it's as simple as that. I mean, in the end, you have to be responsible for how you act and what you do. But nevertheless, the incredible distortion of values and of rights that was implicit in the place, it was always going to come out.
But a lot of people managed to make better choices than some.
Yeah, but a lot of people you wouldn't blame for ending up in the place they ended up in. So.
Yeah. There's no winners there, is there?
No.
No. The book is called The Bureau, and like, I think people will have got a sense of it there. It does, you could read a load of political books and everything, but to evoke the world and how it felt and how it smelt and the textures of the world you grew up in, it's terrific. It's published by River Run, The Bureau by Owen McNamee. Owen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ren.